there's nothing wrong with starting early when you got a legend here, and the legend I've got is our good buddy Pete Baum. Pete, you and I have been on the golf course a couple of times in the last few years.
We have.
But as a chance to get out here and do this, we haven't had the opportunity until now. So tell me, do you miss it?
I do, John. You know, there are days that I would love to be back in the big chair.
Yeah, that's true.
I know that the business has changed a lot, though, since I've been out. And, you know, got to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure I could do it full time.
Yeah.
I think if we were doing it the way we used to do it back in the 80s and 90s,
yeah,
that I could probably handle. But, you know, you see in the big stations, tightened playlists, everything very regimented.
Yeah.
You know, commercial loads. It's very unusual listening to 5 or more minutes at a time of commercials. And it isn't so much that there are that many more advertisers than what we used to do, but the way stations have now gone to formatting, it'll be play 15, 20 minutes at a time of music, then pack all those commercials in at once.
Which does very little value for the advertiser.
No, I don't think it does either.
Yeah.
You know, and in a situation like that, I don't think I would probably last long anymore.
No.
But, no, going back to the way we used to do it, I do miss that.
Well, think about it, and this is what we want to talk about, the way it used to be, not necessarily how bad it is today, although I'm sure we'll touch on that. But just think back, if you would, when what years were you doing it at the station?
I started on air in 1984, May of 1984, as a part-timer.
And, yeah, not originally as Night Rock, though, right?
No, I was on the night shift the whole time.
Always, okay.
Now, when I got hired, is a different story. I was actually hired in, I believe, early, I want to say it was like January or February of 1983.
Okay.
When the station did a talent search. And myself and Stan McCaslin were two of the people who ended up coming out of that as employees. I had not yet started school for broadcasting at that time, so I was getting a lot of my training actually in the studios up there, just sitting in production studio making tapes, you know, trying to refine a style, that kind of thing. Again, I started school that fall of 83 at Lewis and Clark. So that cut into my time a little bit of being able to get up there and train. But then again, I'm actually in school getting my training. So, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, basically.
Sure.
And then I finally got the call, you know, to the bullpen in May 24th, actually, was the day. May 24, 1984 was my first night on. And then I worked part-time for a little over a year. August of 85 is when the Night Rock chair was vacated, and I stepped in and held it for the most part. There were a few breaks in there for a couple months or two where I would do the afternoon shifts. But for the most part, from August of 85 to New Year's Eve of 1993,
I knew you were the longest tenured Night Rock jock. Yeah. That is awesome. We're going to talk with Pete a whole lot more about this coming up next hour, but I just wanted to zip him in here for a second and get him used to the chair. It's not the big chair. It's not the big microphone, but he is here. So we'll
it's
be busy.
It's our chair, and I'm glad to be here, John.
Absolutely. And thank you for wearing a jacket. That's good.
Yeah.
It is a bit brisk. We'll have more with Pete coming up in a few minutes. And there you have it. That's how he used to do it way back when. Pete Baum there announcing Lover Boys Turn Me Loose as we're playing some great 80s videos, some super great VH1 videos that had great music along with them as well. Didn't you think that the 80s had really some superior music?
Yes, I do. Looking back on it, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's there is special to them for some reason or other, John. You know, obviously the 70s mean a lot to some people. The 60s mean a lot to some people. You know, even people will probably crucify me for this. Disco music.
Well, sure, of course, of course.
You know, looking back on it now with the benefit of years and perspective and listening to a lot of music that wasn't that good, you know, in various formats, you start to pick out the good stuff in all the different genres. Like I say, there was some good disco. There was, in my personal opinion, a lot of good new wave.
Sure.
You know, stuff that didn't get played on the radio, stuff that I've discovered since the Internet has come along and opened that all up to all of us. You know, even country music, it's for a lot of years not been my cup of tea. I probably started listening to what would be called current country in mm-hmm. probably the 90s. But, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of good stuff out there now. I don't listen to it a whole lot. You know, it's
I'll tell you, I do, and yes, there is. There's a lot of really good stuff right now.
Yeah.
It's music that has melody, and that's hard to find sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. which is the problem with the most pop music right now. You know,
exactly.
There's not the melody, and there's not a lot of imagination or thought that goes into the music end of it, you know.
I certainly don't want to, you know, pigeonhole just country. I mean, it's tough to find good rock music these days, too.
Yeah, you know,
bet. There's a few bands out there, some stuff that had the program survived, we'd probably be playing.
You'd be playing Greta Van Fleet right now.
Helping to introduce the people, you know, 30 Seconds to Mars, Foo Fighters, Imagine Dragons, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know, for a long time, I resisted new rock music. You know, just for that reason, that I just didn't feel like a whole lot of it had anything to say to me. But I've come around, you know.
Yeah.
People do. You know, like I said, you know, different genres, different time periods, those are all special to people for whatever reason. You know?
Let's go back 35 years, okay? Well, how many would it be? 35 years. Mm-hmm. Go back to 1985.
Yep.
And let's talk about how Night Rock was different than some of the other album-oriented rock stations in the big cities, mm-hmm. and what made Night Rock so special in your mind?
In my opinion, it was because it was listener-driven. We listened to the people, John. You know, and a lot of people will tell you, even back in those days, and it's even worse now, but even back in those days, there was a contest going on in one of the big stations. You had a request you wanted to hear from one of the big stations. Try getting them on the phone. Impossible. Couldn't do it. They didn't answer their phones or couldn't, whatever. But we had four different phone lines that people could reach us on, depending on where they were. And we would try to get as many of the requests on that we could. You know, I mean, we'd get the same ones over and over and over.
Sure.
You know, there was the nightly calls for Children of the Sun and The Legend of Crazy Horse and, you know, Stairway to Heaven and all the, you know, these big songs in this area. And you can't get to them all. And you can't play them over and over and over again. You know, it's part of what we were discussing earlier with shortened playlists. That's what you hear on big radio stations now is the same songs over and over. Because we were what back in those days was known as a free-form album rock station, which means we weren't pre-programmed. We didn't have somebody in New York saying, these are the songs you want to play. You know, this is the audience you want to target. We tried to target everybody. So basically, I'm sitting in that chair and it's my call what goes on the station. But I didn't take that as, hey, this is Pete's Jukebox. I took that as, okay, I'm playing Triumph, Never Surrender right now. What's going to sound good coming out of this? Mm-hmm. You know, people are grooving to this right now. What's going to keep them on that groove? You know, so I targeted it to everybody in the sound of my voice, while still trying to make it sound like I'm talking to you.
Of course.
I'm playing this song for you, you know, each individual person. And that was, to me, the beauty of what we did. And based on the response we had then, based on comments that I still get on the street, you know, or that I see on the internet in the Night Rock group that's out there on Facebook, it worked.
Yeah. Oh, most certainly it worked. And I think one of the other things that made it work was at that particular time, the record industry was so different than it is now. For example, because, you know, WSMI-FM, because Night Rock was what we'd call a reporting station. The record companies wanted to know what you were playing. They wanted to know what the response was, what you were hearing. And you had certain people, there were certain record, what we call A&R guys, the artists and repertory guys who promoted that music. They wanted to know what Pete was getting back, feedback. I know you had several guys that you were reasonably close to. I mean, maybe you never met them, but you talked to them on the phone all the time.
Yep, every week. One of those guys was a guy in New York named Lenny Bronstein. Heavy Lenny.
Yep.
Was his name. He was very, very well known in the rock industry. You know, and that actually brings up another point as to what I tried to accomplish on my time in the chair, which was including as much new music as I could, you know, introducing people to these bands that they weren't going to hear anywhere else, but they were putting out some decent music. And Heavy Lenny was a big piece of that,
you know,
the stuff that he would send us. As you mentioned, things are so much different now, you know, that artists aren't making CDs anymore. It's all done on the internet, you know, everything streams.
What about when you walk into that record library, and again, we go back to talking about a very restrictive playlist these days. When you'd walk into that record library, granted it wasn't all good, but you had 30,000 songs to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
Not 50.
Right.
30,000.
Right.
Not to mention local bands that brought you tapes and you had reels of... you know, we may be a garage band, but this is original. Would you give it a listen? Mm-hmm. You know, we had so much music.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a segment that we would do on Sunday nights when the opportunity presented itself, whenever we would get something from, you know, an area band or artist, where we would put that in for them, get them some airplay. Bands and artists who had already been established, guys like Richie Callison, for instance, out of St. Louis, Billy Peek. Billy was more of a blues artist, but for quite a while he was the lead guitarist in Rod Stewart's band through much of the 70s into the early 80s. Songs like Hot Legs, The Wild Side of Life, Rod Stewart hits, you know. Those are songs that you can very easily recognize Billy's guitar playing on. And, you know, I would acquire these albums on my own, you know, if we didn't have them in the studio, and get that out for those guys. As you were talking about, you know, being a reporting station, what that means is at that time we had, I believe, three trades that we reported to. It was Radio and Records, Friday Morning Quarterback, and the Gavin Report. People in the industry, of course, are going to be very familiar with those, and you know, the regular listeners won't. But what that is those trade magazines would track, you know, the record companies would lean on them to track sales and airplay. And one of my personal favorite stories, one of my proudest accomplishments, I have to tell you, is right before I left in 1993, there was this little band out of Georgia called Collective Soul that had put out a record in, I want to say, March of 93 that didn't really do anything. Well, they came back in late October of 93 and got with people like Heavy Lenny, who we mentioned, to get their record back out there and give it another try. And this record was called Shine. So we started playing that. Now, the way that those trade magazines that we reported to worked back in those days was the 1st of December, they shut down just for the year. You know, people figured, I guess, why add new music at the end of the year?
Right.
I don't really know the rationale for that, but that's the way it worked. So your bigger stations wouldn't add any new music after Thanksgiving. So we had, you know, what, 6-week head start on Shine. And then came the turn of the year. The trades opened back up. The station started adding songs again. And they're over there on their section of the dial going, hey, here's this brand new thing. And I actually have word from someone who used to work there that they would then get people calling going, this record's been out for 2 months. Where you been? So yeah, we were one of the first half dozen stations to be reporting that we were playing Shine. And you know what a huge hit it turned into.
It sure did.
How big it Collective Soul ended up being.
And that's right.
I was saying, I was very proud to be a part of introducing them to the general public.
So many hits to follow, too. Visiting with Pete Baum, Night Rock Jock from 1985 through early 94, right?
My final show was the New Year's Eve Countdown in 1993.
New Year's Eve Countdown in 93.
I actually did end up coming back about a year and a half later, mid-1995, to do news.
Yeah, you know, I remember that.
It wasn't my ending with the station, but it was my time on Night Rock ended that night.
Back with more with Pete in just a minute. We're back with our buddy Pete Baum, Night Rock from 1984 to 1993. And without question, the guy who probably is most well known for Night Rock. Although, just think of who we had. We started out with the precursor of Night Rock with Jim Grubbs and then Bob McMillan. Then it was not for a while. Then it went to country at night. And then that grand experiment came along.
Yeah.
And started out with Mike Perry.
Yes. Mike was like many of us who did the show, a Lewis and Clark grad.
Yeah.
Mike started it in 79, I want to say. Was followed by Dwight Brockman, who you spoke with last week. Dwight also a Lewis and Clark grad. He was there, what, year or two? And then Perry Brown stepped into the chair. I followed Perry, and among some of the others who were part-timers but also quite well-known to people in the area, and I'm sure they'll remember him, guys like Brad Myers, Tim Engels, Brad Weiss, I believe, did some Night Rock for us.
Right.
And then Tom Williams took over after I left and was there until the end, which I got to be honest, John, it escapes me what year that was. I don't remember.
And, you know, I don't remember either, but I know it was not long. It was not long. And, you know, for a station that at the time didn't have anything that was blocking the signal from going a long ways, when the fact that you would have calls from Jacksonville and even Marion and Carbondale and Mattoon and St. Louis all the time, you know, all over the Metro East, it was just something special. Tell me, if you would, what it was like from a standpoint of playing all that music, getting that response from the audience, not only on the phone, but also dropping by to say hello.
Oh, yeah. The big window. Oh, yeah. It's some interesting moments at the window.
Well, you heard Dwight's story at the window, which I thought was pretty good.
I don't know if Dwight ever had anybody who actually broke the window. I did have one person that the window for to describe it to everybody, it was one just a huge, what was it, probably about 8x4,
yeah, at least,
picture window with two
side lights.
Yeah, two side lights that were like three panes each, and we did have one person who knocked a little bit hard on one of those panes in the side lights and kind of had to employ some plywood there for a little
really
while.
Really wanted your attention, you
yeah,
because I guess you had the headphones on or something like that.
And I do recall one person that came that. This actually brings up another story regarding the reach of the station and, you know, how what we did impacted people. I used to get phone calls from over at Graham Correctional Center all the time,
mm-hmm,
over in Hillsboro. And it was funny the way these guys would work the system because they weren't able to actually call out. What they would do, and this might be educating some of the younger people, what they would do is they would place a collect call to the station. And to keep us from having to pay for a collect call, what they would do, I'd pick up the phone, and I'd hear this operator saying, "You have a collect call from," and then one of these, one of the residents of Graham would then say, "Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven."
Yeah.
That way I know they're making their request, and I don't have to pay for a phone call
because that's right.
That would come out of my check at the end of every couple of weeks.
I understand.
But I actually had one of the guys who was housed there for a couple of years. After he got out, one of the first places he stopped was at my window. And he come in, he said, "I had to stop here. I had to thank you for getting me through these last 2 years." And it's like, well, what do you say to that, John? That's amazing.
You never know.
That's amazing, man. You know, so, like I said, it demonstrates just what we did, you know, and the effect that it had on people and how we helped.
You never know who's listening,
mm-hmm,
until they call you or write you a letter and let you know.
Yeah.
And it's always good to know who is listening, because you assume. But you said it right when we first started talking. You said, "I'm not talking to 1,000. I'm not talking to a group. I'm talking to you."
Mm-hmm.
And that's who we're talking to. Yeah. You know, we're talking to that one person.
Right. Now, when that time came, yeah, we were there to be able to reach thousands of people at a time. Probably the biggest incident in my tenure there would have been the Butler gas leak.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think took place in 1991, I want to say. December, very, very chilly night. And somebody digging a trench over there accidentally caught a gas main. It was a very humid night for being in December, so the air is very heavy, and this gas can't dissipate, this natural gas. A lot of the area had to be evacuated, including us eventually.
Mm-hmm.
They let us broadcast for as long as we could. It was a Friday night, so we had a basketball game going on, and about halfway through that, Terry, I believe, was the one who was doing the game, finally said, "Hey, we've got something much more important going on right now. We'll give you the rest of this basketball game tomorrow or whenever."
Mm-hmm.
And that was what we did for the rest of the night. You know, I scaled back, you know, left the AC/DC in the library, scaled back the music a little bit to make it a little more palatable, because I knew I had a lot more people who weren't regular Night Rock listeners tuned in. And we kept the updates coming. At one point, as I said, eventually we ended up having to vacate the studio because this natural gas cloud was making its way toward us. You know, this giant tower that we got sitting out there throwing off, you know, all sorts of electricity. So,
oh yeah,
we shut it down, and Tim and I ended up driving out to Honey Bend to the big stick out there, the tower. We're broadcasting from an incredibly cold cinder block building, you know, and just doing what we could until it was safe.
Yeah. What were you, were you just talking? Were you playing music somehow out there?
We did have a few cassettes, you know, there were promo items that were sent in by the record company for giveaways. Uh-huh. So we grabbed a couple of those. I think there was some Jethro Tull. I don't remember what else.
Really?
Yeah, we kind of had to play the same songs over and over just to fill the airtime in between updates.
But, I guess.
We actually had a second mic that we ran out to Brian's truck because he had a two-way radio out there.
Uh-huh.
And that was how we were getting the updates back, as Randy, I believe it was on site, you know, or well, as close to on site as he could get, on one end of the, you know, basically a walkie-talkie, you know, a CB radio. And we ran the mic out and just basically held it up to Brian's end of the two-way, and that was how we got the updates to people.
One of the things Dwight talked about last week was the incredible shock or feeling when you would hear the teletype do the bells.
Yeah.
You know, did you ever have any, I don't think you ever had a five bell alarm, but you may have had something, you know, I don't know if you ever did.
Nothing really jumps out. I after listening to Dwight's segment, I kind of thought back, you know, wondering about the same thing, and there's nothing that really jumps out. Now there was, this is when I was still a part-timer in 1984. I was at the station that night for some reason. I wasn't on air. Brad Myers was actually doing the on-air work that night. But that was New Year's Eve, the night that Def Leppard drummer Rick Allen got into his auto accident in England, which he ended up losing his arm. And, of course,
became a very famous one-armed drummer.
Yeah. As a drummer, you think you have to have two. But, eventually he proved people wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but that pretty much stands out as the only time that I remember as far as the teletype machine goes. There was one other incident that I was actually a part of when I was also still a part-timer, which was the first concert that, you know, as a station member, you know, you get one of the benefits that we had was, you know, being able to see those shows for free.
Yeah.
And this was my first one. It was in Springfield, the Prairie Capital Convention Center, and it was Aerosmith. Well, this being 1984, Aerosmith hadn't cleaned up quite yet.
Yeah.
And they got through somehow, got through back in the saddle to open the show. Rats in the Cellar was the next song, and Steven Tyler couldn't remember any of the words. He actually fell off the stage during that song.
Oh, gosh.
They had one of those industrial fans that's like, you know, 3 or 4 feet around, those huge things
right.
that you see. He's laying back on it like this, you know, splayed out like he's on, you know, being nailed to the cross, his arms out, you know, just this pose. Obviously, the heroin was hitting hard.
Oh, boy. Lucky the scarf didn't get pulled down into the blades, right?
Yeah, yeah. During the third song, which I don't remember what it was, it might have been Last Child, but during that song, he punched Brad Whitford, his guitar player.
Oh,
that was a surreal scene.
I would
obviously
imagine.
Never saw anything like that before. But you know, being on scene, we actually turned into reporters that night.
Yeah,
so
we're
at a payphone. You know, there's another thing. Maybe kids don't know what that is these days. But yeah, we're at a payphone in the Prairie Capital Convention Center, calling back updates to Brad back at the studio.
Did you ever walk back into that record library and say, "Man, I wish I had this at home." Or I wish there was some easy way to save all that.
I had the whole library.
Yeah.
That's
what I meant, the whole library.
5,000-6,000 albums, sure.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day, when we go back and show it to people, it just doesn't have the impact that it did, say, 30 years ago, because, you know, half of them say, what's that?
Right.
You know, they've never seen one.
Right.
I used to laugh when Terry, bless his heart, would take people on tours. He would always, they would always at one time crowd inside his office, and he would close the door, and behind the door on the wall, he had a rack, and he had still had some 45s that he had just kind of saved for posterity up there.
Yeah.
And I always got a kick out of, because the first one was Warren Zevon on Elektra and Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which I thought was the most appropriate thing, you know, for our business and for Warren Zevon, and that was so good. But Lawyers, Guns, and Money was that first record that was up there. People don't realize today how easy it is to say, Alexa, play something, you know, or I could say, hey, Siri, but see, I don't want to do that. My phone would start doing it. But the thing of it is, we used to have to queue up records.
Yep.
You know, the fact that, oh, I had somebody would call and say, I want, you'd have to go, thank goodness they were alphabetized, but you'd have to get up, physically walk 30 or 40 feet and go pull an album out and queue up the track. It actually took effort, a little bit of time.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure people are out there like, oh, that sounds so hard. But
sometimes when the record's ending and you hadn't got the next one up yet, it's not hard.
Yeah. And you know, that's so funny you say that, John. I guarantee you do too. But every person that used to be in the business that I still talk to, we all still have the dream. We all still have the nightmare.
Oh,
man, my record's running out, and I got nothing on the next turntable.
Uh-huh.
It still happens. I've been out of the business, what, 25, 30 years, and I still have that dream. But, but you're right. You know, people nowadays, you talk about how that probably doesn't impress them as much. You know, they say, oh, well, here's this MP3 player I've got. It's got 10,000 songs on it. What's the big deal? Yeah. I get that, but part of the issue that you have with digital music like that is it doesn't sound as good, for one thing.
True, true.
You know, that I think back to sitting there, you know, when I would have the opportunity to actually just sit and listen to one of the songs that I had on, you know, got the headphones on, and just how rich the sound is, you know, and I go back now and get on one of the streaming sites, you know, and listen to the same thing, and it's like, well, wait a minute, there's notes missing from that guitar part. Something here doesn't sound right.
Yeah. Oh, just where's the richness?
Yeah.
You know, it's not there. I know we all have songs that are favorites, and I remember, of course, listening and having my favorites, and actually would occasionally call and say, hey, Pete, there's somebody, this is John, would you play? Yeah, I'll try and get to it. There's 45 ahead of you, you know, kind of that thing. But things like we all had our favorites like you did. And I remember, you know, like you would say one time I saw you put on Facebook, this was one of the favorites. I love to hear Roger Hodgson play Had a Dream, you know, which was, again, a very lush-sounding record. Mm-hmm. I think that was one thing that the album-oriented rock stations had that a lot of, say, the AM rockers before didn't have, is that by the time that FM rock stations were really in their heyday, the music got really, really lush. I mean, the orchestration, the orchestras, you know, that were part of it. Mellotron was a great invention to help music as well. There are so many songs that have so much behind them, you know, that make them really stand out. Yeah. Whereas, you know, in the 60s, you didn't really have that.
Right, right. I mean, even the song you played earlier, Curie, by Mr. Mister. When I came in 85, you know, rock music, in my opinion, was in kind of a lull. It wasn't really the best time for it.
Mm-hmm.
Curie's a good song. I like it. I played it then. It was near the top of the charts. So was Broken Wings, which, you know, by the same band, is really more of a, you know, a pop radio song. pop radio classic, but it was near the top of the album charts at that time. You know, so we were playing it. I mean, you know, listen to one of the big stations now, you're not going to hear that song.
No.
But like I said, back then, it was a big hit. You know, that goes back to what we were talking about before. You know, everybody's got their favorite genres. Everybody's got their favorite time periods. But yeah, with the birth of FM back, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, you really see the progression of the music, you know, the styles of music that gave album radio its birth.
Oh, yeah.
And we still leaned on that quite a bit. At least I certainly tried to anyway when I was in the chair. I'd still throw in your Yardbirds songs, you know, your Cream, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Unless it's like White Room, you're not going to hear a Cream song on the radio anymore.
No, you're right. We're going to come back and have one more segment with Pete. We're back with Pete Baum. Pete Baum, Night Rock DJ from 1984 to New Year's Eve, 1993. What was that last countdown show like? We know it was your last day.
Bittersweet, definitely. I really hated to have to move on, John, but it just got to the point that, you know, I had kids growing and working nights all those times, you know, having to maybe miss a few things that they were involved in. So, you know, it came time to you know, start concentrating on that a little bit more. Yeah, every night in that chair was so much fun. You know, I had no complaints whatsoever. You know, that's one of the things that I wanted to make sure, you know, while I was here that you know, we got an opportunity to talk about and an opportunity to say was, you know, how much I enjoyed my time there, how much I appreciated the opportunities that were given to me by the Tally family, you know, by Brian, by Hayward. It's one of the things that, you know, as you and I talked about and have talked about before, you know, off air, the state of the business now. You know, community radio, the way it is done by WSMI, is getting harder to find.
Oh, boy, yeah.
You know, it's good to know that the station is still doing, you know, your basketball games, still doing, you know, well, before COVID and when there were homecomings and county fairs, et cetera, you know, we're still there to broadcast from those and you know, give people an opportunity if they can't actually be there at the event to still be there.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's one of the, you know, as far as the service aspects of the time that I was there, you know, we talked about the night of the gas leak. You know, one of the other big moments that I was proud to be at the station while it was happening was, you know, Staunton's 1993 basketball title run.
Oh, yeah.
You know, being able to be there in the chair listening to the games, you know, if I wasn't there, you know, being at the celebration, you know, when they came back to town the next day after winning it all, and seeing, you know, how people were just in love with this team, you know, and the effect that had on the whole town. Those kind of things, you know, like I said, I'm very proud to have been a part of. And, it's difficult to still find that. But WSMI has been doing that and doing it very, very well throughout its entire existence. That's why they're celebrating 70 years this year on the AM, 60 on the FM, because what they're doing very well. You know, they're doing it right.
Yeah, it is definitely true. You know, we laugh sometimes. I mean, those of us at the station, we laugh when somebody says, I didn't know that... that you guys did some of those things. And I said, well, how do you think some of it gets on the air? Or, you know, we go back, you and I have been around the station for many, many years. We say you go back to 1980s, early 80s, when you first started coming to the station. The news has changed so much. Mm-hmm. You know, networks. You know, we used to be so proud, and we were, of having, say, the Mutual Radio Network, if you remember. Mm-hmm. Because Mutual was a radio network. It wasn't a stepchild of TV news. Mm-hmm. And it was great. But, you know, Mutual eventually was bought out by Westwood One, and then it became CNN News. And it's just been a struggle to find a good news service, you know, since, because they keep getting swallowed up and changed. And I guess the ones that really stand out are basically at all the Clear Channel stations, and their signal goes so far that, you know, we can't get a couple of them that maybe we'd like to have. Mm-hmm. But you have to have something, you know, and so thank goodness we do still have a national news service. And not every station can say that.
Right.
But keeping one at times has been a struggle, mm-hmm. because there's just not many to choose from anymore.
Yeah.
That's a sad thing. Yeah. But on the other hand, we try and do our best to keep up with the local news, too. I mean, you think about it over the years. It took a lot to have three news studios, you know, not only the main studio, but Carlinville and in Greenville. And for the longest time, you know, until the Greenville one basically proved to not necessarily be necessary anymore. But Carlinville still, and just having that news and the number of people who work on it, everybody gets to do news. You know, you remember that, because mm-hmm. like you said, how many times were you pressed into service?
Right.
So that's a big part of it.
Right. Yeah, it's the personalization, you know, that's such a huge part of it. I mean, you can get your news on the internet. You know, you can go to Facebook and see what the big news is, but you know, it's the personalization. You know, when you need to know something local, it's stations like WSMI where you need to go to get that information.
That's for sure. And it's as simple as a boil order, or as important as, like you said, a gas leak or something like that. Mm-hmm. Pete, I sure appreciate you being here for the last hour. I've been looking forward to it, and I know you have too.
Sure.
Thanks for the stories about Night Rock.
I'm glad to do it, John. This hour went way too fast for me.
I know. Well, maybe we'll do another one 10 years from now. Let's hope we're still around.
I hope so.
You betcha. Take care, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, brother.